Welcome to Open Your Eyes, a podcast about opening our eyes to a new view of life. Thanks for joining us today. We don't take it lightly that you choose to listen to Open Your Eyes, and we feel a responsibility to share messages that make a difference. So this podcast is intended to help you and me to see ourselves, our life, and our circumstances in a new light. So as you listen today, we hope you get a new view of you and your potential to lead and live better. And when you're done listening today, be sure to share this podcast with a friend. It just might be what they need in their life today. Let's get started. Today, I'd like to share a few suggestions, most of them not mine, that can help us all live our best life now. More than a decade ago, I used to run outside every morning early. And someone told me that running outside in the weather conditions made you strong. It's probably true. But on those early mornings, I fell in love with podcasts. They made me think as I ran, and it put in my mind and heart ideas that would stay with me and infused me with new thoughts. One of the podcasts that I would load onto my old iPod Nano that could fit into my pocket with my earphone cord tucked under my shirt were the sermons from Joel Osteen. He just had this cheery disposition, and they were simple messages that caused me to believe in my potential. One year, I went to Houston, Texas to run the marathon there on New Year's Day. And while I was there, my friend Raphael took me to Joel Osteen's church called Lakewood Church. Lakewood was started by Joel's father, John. As John got older, one day he asked his youngest son, Joel, to deliver Joel's first sermon. Joel had never done this before. He had worked behind the scenes for 17 years doing media, production, and other duties for his father. And it wasn't the first time that his dad had asked him to step onto the stage. Each time his father asked, Joel had turned him down. Then things changed. John, now in his 70s, asked his 35-year-old son, Joel, to deliver that first sermon. And for whatever reason, that day, Joel felt an unexplainable shift inside him, and he agreed. That was on a Monday. As the week progressed, Joel was more and more nervous. He didn't think he could do it. He wasn't a skilled teacher. Sometimes he had a hard time speaking. He was afraid of the large shadow his father cast, and he knew people would compare him to his father, something he knew he could never live up to. But then on Friday, his father had to go to the hospital because of complications with dialysis. John had been on dialysis for a few months, but was otherwise very healthy. So from the hospital, his father listened to his son deliver his first sermon. When Joel returned to the hospital to visit with his dad, the nurses stopped him in the hall and said, "Joel, we've never seen your dad so proud. He just beamed with joy." Well, the next Friday, Osteen's father had a sudden heart attack and passed away. "He went to be with the Lord," Osteen says. "I thought, what are the coincidences of me speaking the last Sunday of his life?" Well, after coping with the shock of his dad's passing, Joel said, "I felt a feeling that said to me, I'm supposed to step up and pastor the church." And again, every thought said, "Are you crazy? You've spoken one time. You think you're going to get up there and pastor it?" But I knew I was supposed to do it. Well, in the beginning, Joel tried to imitate his father's style. But soon he realized that he was never going to be like his dad. He was reading one day in the scripture, and what he read was talking about David. And it said that David fulfilled his purpose for his generation. Joel decided that his dad's purpose was his dad's, and Joel had a purpose of his own. So he started to preach in his own way with his own message. And his message resonated. The church grew exponentially. When John Osteen died, Lakewood Church only needed one Sunday service. But by the following January, Lakewood expanded to 3 services on Sunday and 1 on Saturday night under Joel. 2 years later, Lakewood would sign a lease to take over the Compaq Center, the former home of the Houston Rockets, to accommodate the numbers of those who wanted to hear Joel speak. The quiet camera guy grew into a powerful preacher. Now, over the years, I've written down a few quotes from Joel that have stuck with me. Here are a few. "Don't use your energy to worry. Use your energy to believe." This one statement helped me to stop playing that loop in my head. You know, the one that worries and stresses about something over and over again? The next quote from Joel: you need to associate with people who inspire you, people that challenge you to rise higher, people that make you better. Don't waste your valuable time with people that are not adding to your growth. Your destiny is too important. I made some significant changes in my life after this lesson. I started paying close attention to the people I worked with and interacted with. I believe your destiny and mine are too important to stick around and be with caustic people. Another Joel Osteen teaching: you can change your world by changing your words. Words do create worlds. This is such a true principle. The words you speak to others and the words you speak to yourself. Change these and you change your focus and your friends. Another: you will never change what you tolerate. I remember the day I heard this lesson. As I listened to it, I reflected on the things in my life, both in my habits, in my work, in my interactions, that I tolerated. It was a big perspective change for me in my life. Joel also said, you may think there's a lot wrong with you, but there is also a lot right with you. One of the most impactful messages from Joel in my life was this: God doesn't leave us where we are. He'll put us in situations to separate what is limiting us and bring us to be a better, more capable person. This is so true. When you're in a place where you need God's help, you're probably in the exact spot where you need to become better. Okay, one more. Just because we're in a stressful situation doesn't mean that we have to get stressed out. You may be in a storm. The key is, don't let the storm get into you. Okay, I can't resist. One more. The life in front of you is far more important than the life behind you. All of these are powerful lessons. One more powerful lesson that happened recently at Lakewood Church was this. As I mentioned, the Lakewood Church is held in the former Compaq Center where the Houston Rockets basketball team played. It's a large stadium, and it was full the Sunday that I attended. And not only full for one session, but for four sessions. It is a testament to how much people need encouragement and faith. Not long ago, Janessi Moreno, a 36-year-old single mother, made the decision to go to Lakewood Church. Moreno had a history of mental issues. She had been arrested for forgery, drug possession, illegal possession of a weapon, and other offenses. She had even donated to Lakewood Church in the past. Well, Moreno went to Lakewood, parked her car, put on a trench coat, put an AR-15 under her coat along with another weapon in her bag. She walked into the church after the service ended, bringing her 7-year-old son with her. When she got into the hallway, she opened fire. As she opened fire, two off-duty police officers ran down the hall and sprang into action. The shooter shot a man in the hallway, hitting him in the leg. As the police officers approached the woman, one officer told her to put her weapon down. She refused and kept firing. In the firing, her 7-year-old son was hit by a bullet. Then the policeman shot and killed the woman. Well, following this tragedy, I wondered how many people would be at Osteen's service the following Sunday. Would services even be held? Would people be afraid to attend? Well, services were held, and people filled the church, and Osteen delivered a message. His message included a prayer for the 7-year-old boy and his family. Osteen expressed gratitude for what God did for the people in attendance and for those who were there during the shooting. I remembered what Joel said once: when you abandon your fear, when you're really believing, when you're in peace, you're showing God by your actions that you trust Him. I also believe that when we show God by our actions that we trust Him, good things happen. Well, all of this has led me to think about the value of good teaching in our life. Whether it is a sermon or lessons from a leadership book or words from wise friends, we are lifted and changed in our life by these lessons. And these lessons may not see us through a shooting, but they can see us through an illness, the loss of a loved one, a needed change, or a mental or emotional struggle. In your life, you can probably make a list of lessons that you've learned. and tell a story or two of how these lessons have changed your life. So I thought today I would share a few lessons that are not mine, but are the small things we can do in business and life to help us rise and become a bit better at whatever we're trying to do. Here's the first. Whatever you're trying to do, especially in dealing with people or things, you can put things that need to be done on your calendar to follow up. You can return that call in the future. You can try to remember to do what needs to be done. But here's what I've learned. Do it now. Salespeople know better than anyone how important response time is. If you respond to the client quickly, it shows your interest, your desire to serve, and you're most likely to get them while they are interested. One author wrote, the data can back this up. A 2021 study looked at over 5.7 million inbound leads and determined which were the most likely to convert. The answer? The ones a rep responded to in less than 5 minutes. If those leads weren't attended to in the first 5 minutes, the chances of them converting plummeted by a factor of 8. 5 minutes is all it takes to miss out on a lot of potential revenue. It makes you think, doesn't it, about the power of doing it now. I also get stressed when there are too many things on my to-do list. Several times in my life, I've had so much to do. Large organizations to lead, volunteer jobs to keep up with, and more. And once in a while, people ask me how I managed. My answer was simple. I do it now. If a text comes in, unless I'm in a meeting or talking to a person, I try to answer it quickly. The same with important emails, needs from friends, and other things. Now, I'm far from perfect, but I found greater peace and control of things in my life when I do it now. Sometimes my wife hates this habit. If there's something to be done in the house, I try to act on it. It can interfere with other things, but this is an incredibly powerful habit. I've learned I need to be significantly less organized if I act immediately. If you're thinking of reaching out to someone or saying thank you, do it now. Things we put off tend to be easier to put off the more we do it. And when it comes to decisions, this habit will carry over and help you in big ways. When I was 15 years old, I went on a trip to Lake Powell. Now, Lake Powell is a man-made lake with miles of high cliffs. It's an incredible place to water, ski, wakeboard, vacation, and more importantly, cliff jump. My friends and I pulled up to a famous cliff, climbed to the top of the cliff, and held on to one end of our 50-foot ski rope and let the other end fall. It hung a few feet off the water. When I climbed to the top and looked down, I immediately froze. It was petrifying. When you're that high, you start to think, how deep is the water? Are there rocks under the water? Should I bend my legs because if I land straight, my leg will break? What if I drift in the air and land on my stomach? All sorts of thoughts enter your head of what could go wrong. Well, I was first on the cliff, but I wasn't the first to jump. I was afraid, and I started to come back down. But one of my friends climbed to the top. As he reached the top, he just picked up speed and ran right off the cliff, no hesitation. Well, inspired, I climbed the cliff again, stepped up to the edge, inched as low as I could on the cliff, and then I counted 1, 2, 3 and jumped. Ever since then, I've just said 1, 2, 3, go. On any small decision, just count 1, 2, 3 and jump into action. This keeps us from thinking too much. You see, too often we want complete assurance that there are no rocks. We want to know the depth of the water. We want perfect instructions as to how to land the right way and so forth. So we wait. Don't wait. Act. And don't forget, action infuses your life with new energy, ideas, relationships, sense of pride. Inaction brings confusion, disappointment, sense of loss, nothing new. I believe that when you're dealing with people, this habit of acting immediately says that you're important to me. And you'll find that this helps you gain influence, grow stronger relationships, and feel better about your own interactions. Another lesson, be responsive. In this digital age in which we live, this is critical. William Vanderloman shared this story about his company. When we interview a new candidate and we're vetting them as to whether to offer them a job, there's a significant chance they'll get a text message from someone on our team. not necessarily the person who interviewed them, but someone they talked to here at some point. They'll likely get the text at a late night hour, maybe around 10:30 p.m. The message will probably be some kind of weird question such as, okay, the Astros have won over 50 games before the All-Star break. How many teams that do that also win the World Series? Do you know? If they don't answer, it doesn't mean they'll lose the job. But if they answer within the first minute saying, haha, I love the Astros too, then they'll get a big-time bonus and another point for answering within 1 minute, which aligns with the idea of ridiculous responsiveness. If they answer with something like, well, I looked it up and only three teams have done that, the Rangers did it twice and the Astros once, but the Astros blew the World Series and the Rangers won both times, then I know, A, they're ridiculously responsive, B, they've made me go, wow, and C, they've shown solution side living, and D, they've shown contagious fun because they're snarky about the Astros, which is fine by us. You see, the power of acting immediately also teaches our brains that we're going to act immediately. And soon the habit, the feeling of acting, changes. In his book, Oliver Berkman points out that much of the time when we say things like, I just can't get out of bed early in the morning, or I just can't get myself to exercise, what we really mean is that we can't get ourselves to feel like doing these things. After all, no one is tying you to your bed every morning. Intimidating bouncers aren't blocking the entrance to your gym. Physically, nothing is stopping you. You just don't feel like it. But as Berkman asks, who says you need to wait until you feel like doing something in order to start doing it? Think about that for a minute, because it's really important. Somewhere along the way, we've all bought into the idea, without consciously realizing it, that to be motivated and effective, we need to feel like we want to take action. We need to be eager to do so. I really don't know why we believe this, because it is 100% nonsense. Yes, on some level, you need to be committed to what you're doing. You need to want to see the project finished or get healthier or get an earlier start to your day, but you don't need to feel like doing it. In fact, many of the most prolific artists, writers, and innovators have become so in part because of their reliance on habits that force them to act no matter how uninspired they felt. Berkman reminds us of a renowned artist, Chuck Close's observation that inspiration is for amateurs. The rest of us just show up and get to work. Next, a related lesson. Throughout our day, we are often inspired, not in big ways, just brief thoughts, maybe even ideas that come to us. Sometimes we wonder if they're inspiration or not. But here's what I've learned. Following inspiration is a learned skill. And soon as you follow those promptings quickly, you learn how to discern which thoughts are inspiration and which are not. For example, almost without exception in my workday, I may get an impression about someone on my team. Usually the impression is to thank them or to follow up with them, to assist them in some way. And it's easy to say to yourself, I'll do that later. But inspiration comes for a reason. You may ask, what is the source of that inspiration? Well, I believe many, not all, are heaven sent. Why? Because all good things have a source. So why not act when inspired? You may get the inspiration to give someone a compliment. Don't wait. You may be inspired to send a message, make a call, reach out to someone. Don't wait. When you get the inspiration to get out of bed and get to the gym or whatever it is, follow the inspiration. So often, we get a bit of inspiration and we don't write it down. I found that writing down inspiration can and does make a difference. Next, it's really important in life to determine how we'll respond to change. I see so many people and organizations stall because they're not agile. They don't respond well. Change freezes their action, and they spend more mental energy talking about and worrying about the change than moving forward. Think about it. The agile person or business will win every time. The economy changes, business circumstances change, your life changes, but how you respond and how quickly you respond will make all the difference. One author said, I find more and more things are being done because that's the way they've always been done. Too often, teams fall into complacency, finding a solution that worked once and sticking to it stubbornly. Similarly, I find that when problems arise, too often people just say they can't be solved. Have you ever heard the phrase, build a bridge and get over it? That's what agile people do when something changes. They figure out a way and get started quickly on adapting to change. If there were anything you could do to prepare your team or children or family to prepare for the future and what will happen in the world in the future, it would be to get agile and get past the hurt or confusion or disappointment that's forced on us by change. Build a bridge and get over it. When we understand that change is unavoidable and that no matter what we do in our life, we'll encounter change and we can either get frustrated or grow with it, once we accept this, change becomes much easier to deal with. In fact, it can push you forward to becoming who you're supposed to become and develop in you the ability to be agile for changes still to come in your life. Agility is a 21st century skill. Next lesson. Muhammad Ali was often known to say, "I am the greatest." He seemed to lack no confidence and prided himself on his abilities and looks. As the story goes, one day a plane carrying a number of passengers, including Muhammad Ali, was going through some rough turbulence. The captain turned on the seatbelt sign, made an announcement to the passengers to put on their seatbelts, and asked the flight attendants to ensure all were buckled in. Muhammad Ali, however, ignored the request. One of the flight attendants came and asked him to buckle his seatbelt, to which Ali replied, "Superman don't need no seatbelt." To which the flight attendant responded, "Superman don't need no plane." Humility is not an easy virtue to acquire or practice, and it's even more difficult to apply personally in all of life's situations. And it's easy to see how others may need humility rather than focus on our own need to be humble. Oliver Wendell Holmes said, "Humility is the first of the virtues for other people." At one point in his life, Benjamin Franklin set out to practice and acquire moral virtues. He wrote, "It was about this time that I conceived the bold and arduous project of arriving at moral perfection, as I knew or thought I knew what was right and wrong. I didn't see why I might not always be perfect and avoid being imperfect." Well, Franklin made a list of 12 areas of attitude and action that needed improvement. And the 27-year-old Philadelphian asked a friend to look over his list. His friend would later tell Franklin something that awakened the need for the 13th virtue. Franklin wrote in his autobiography that his friend kindly informed me that I was generally thought proud, that my pride showed itself frequently in conversation. Well, humility became the 13th virtue in his project. Pride is your greatest enemy. Humility, your greatest friend. As C.S. Lewis wrote, humility is not thinking less of yourself, it's thinking of yourself less. You know, recently, a new study published in the Journal of Positive Psychology shared results from several studies on humility. The first, a large group of students were tested using a survey to determine which students scored higher on characteristics of humility and which did not. Then the same group of students were shown a campus radio broadcast, which included a story about a woman whose parents and sister had died in a car crash and was having difficulty in college. Well, after the broadcast, the sign-up sheet was given to ask for volunteers to help her. Almost all of those who scored high on humility signed up. Very few of those who scored low on the humility scale signed up. Humble people value other people in real and authentic ways. Well, in the same article, another study of 1,000 workers found that organizations with humble leaders had more engaged employees and less voluntary turnover. How does this happen? Well, truly humble people want to serve. You know, the same view works in parenting. When we see our children as having immense potential, able to teach us, and of immense value to God, we treat them differently. When we are humble and see ourselves accurately as still learning and growing and of potentially lesser value than our kids, we open ourselves to growth and learning. We put on the power of humility. I believe that when you put on the power of humility, you also put on the power to influence people, to find your own happiness. And in a strange way, in the end, you're more successful at your business, family, and other endeavors in life. We all have worked for or with people who approach business measuring success by their own achievements, title changes, promotions, and how many accolades come their way. I've worked for people who can only measure their success if they feel satisfied with the attention they garner or if their own moods or needs are met. And you know what? These people are rarely happy. They run to and fro trying to find happiness, but it eludes them. And they think life will measure them according to their title or wealth, when in fact, it won't. Okay, the next simple lesson. Extend grace. Be generous. As someone once said, the law of prosperity is generosity. If you want more, give more. In other words, give more than you take, and you'll get more than you give. One morning in August, at a drive-through window at a Starbucks in St. Petersburg, Florida, a customer paid for her order and then picked up the tab for the stranger in the car in line behind her. Then that customer paid the bill for the next customer in line, and so on for the next 330 customers in a three-hour sequence of spontaneous generosity. In early 1992, the presidential campaign in the United States was heating up. After an ugly primary season, embattled Bill Clinton was taking on not one, but two candidates, the incumbent president George Bush and independent candidate Ross Perot. The campaign was nastier than most, with critics taking shots at George Bush for not holding the line on taxes and appearing weak and blaming him for the poor economy. Some taking shots at Clinton for an affair he had had with Jennifer Flowers. Well, the rhetoric coming from Perot was especially critical of Bush and his running mate Dan Quayle. And in the end, Clinton took 43% of the vote, Bush 37 and Perot 19. Nothing about the loss seemed fair to George Bush, who felt he had not only run a good campaign, but also led the country admirably for the prior 4 years. Well, it's tradition for outgoing presidents to leave a note for incoming presidents, a tradition that hasn't been followed of late. When Bill Clinton walked into the Oval Office for the first time as president, there was a letter waiting for him from George Bush. Here's what it said. "Dear Bill, when I walked into this office just now, I felt the same sense of wonder and respect that I felt 4 years ago. I know you will feel it too. I wish you great happiness here. There will be tough times, made even more difficult by criticism you may not think is fair. I'm not a very good one to give advice, but just don't let the critics discourage you or push you off your course. You will be our president when you read this. I wish you and your family well. Your success is now our country's success. I'm rooting for you." Grace is so easy to give and so powerful when it's received. Hillary Clinton says the letter made her cry when she first read it, and she cried again when she heard Bush had passed away years later. Referring to the letter and the grace he showed, she said, "That's the America we love." She said, "That's what we cherish and expect." Now, I suspect if we each measured our generosity, the propensity we have to rejoice in the other person's success, the likelihood we will extend a compliment or write a note, the chance we will seize the opportunity to talk good about someone who has done us wrong, and the probability we will be kind when we're stressed or impatient, we may see that we all need to improve. Give for the right reason, and that is for no reason at all. So as we end today, remember, don't use your energy to worry. Use your energy to believe. You can change your world by changing your words. You will never change what you tolerate. You may think there's a lot wrong with you, but there's also a lot right with you. Do it now. Follow the inspiration that comes your way quickly. Get agile in how you respond to change and let humility and generosity guide your life. And watch. You'll become a person who influences because of your character. And most of all, thanks for being here today. And don't forget to join us next week for another podcast as we learn to open our eyes to who and what we can become.